Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is reporter Myron Jobson, making his podcast debut. Don't worry, we'll go easy on you, Myron. And coming up, has the bubble truly burst on Bitcoin as the price of the cryptocurrency nosedived this week? Simon offers us some lessons from its rise and fall. From the ridiculous to the sublime, Myron instead takes a look at the shareholder heroes. We're whispering it softly, but could brighter times be in store for savers? And we ask, is it ever a good idea to buy a home with no deposit? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
But first, let me take you back to this time last year. Simon? Thank you very much, Simon. The price of Bitcoin had already risen eightfold since the start of 2017, but just under a month later, it had more than doubled, rising another 140% to a high of $19,783 on the 17th of December. Surely it couldn't last. No, it really couldn't. This week saw a 30% drop from its value, and today the price of Bitcoin is around $4,500. So that's 46% below this time last year. So if you'd have put £10,000 investment in Bitcoin at its December high, that would now be worth £2,300. So what does one of the most striking bubbles of our time have to teach us? Simon, you've been looking at this for your column, as you yourself put a wee punt on it in February. But first, welcome to the podcast, Myron. Have you ever put money in cryptocurrencies?
Thankfully, no. Tempted, I have to say, around mid-December last year, but I thought, no.
Every man, woman and his dog, I think, was tempted around that time, to be fair. Easy one for you first off. Reminders of Bitcoin, it's not an easy one, but more generally cryptocurrencies. And why did people just get so excited about it?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Put simply, cryptocurrency is a form of digital money that is designed to be secured and, in many cases, anonymous. Bitcoin is the first and probably best known one. They run on a distributed public ledger called blockchain. You may have heard of blockchain, which is a record of all transactions updated and held by current holders.
So it's not physical money.
No.
Some people say it's more like a commodity than it is a currency. But what was so great about it? What was so appealing? Because you clearly, I see your face there, Myron, you're like, nah. I mean, we can all say that now, can't we, as it's dropped 30% this week. But, you know, what was all the hype about?
Well, that's it, isn't it? It's what you said. It seems like everyone, like the dentist, the taxi driver, and your dog was telling you to buy Bitcoin the run of Christmas and cryptocurrency. I suppose the idea is that they're supposed to change the way in which we spend money. Apparently, as the technology boasts a faster and safer data transfer than previous methods. But on the technical side, you know, speculation that the launch of Bitcoin futures, which are contracts on assets bought at an agreed price but delivered and paid for later, would attract investment for institutional investors. So banks and insurance companies and pension funds. And that triggered the sharp hike in Bitcoin that we saw last December.
It's what you said last week, wasn't it, Simon? It's all about sentiment, isn't it?
Yes. Look, the reason why I wrote about this was because this time last year, if you thought Bitcoin had risen a lot, then you were in for something else in the weeks to come. Because Bitcoin had gone up eightfold since the start of the year, at the end of November last year. Not many things go up eightfold in a year. So we'd already seen a pretty spectacular run. But what we then saw was a line that pretty much went straight up in the air as Bitcoin just rocketed up to that peak of $19,783 on the 17th of December. I mean, you could actually overlay the Bitcoin chart onto the classic bubble chart and they pretty much mapped out exactly. But there was this question of, well, maybe it's not a bubble. Maybe it actually is different this time because cryptocurrency has a value because cryptocurrency is the future. Cryptocurrency is the future of money. And it wasn't just Bitcoin. It was all these other cryptocurrencies that were coming out of the woodwork. You had Ethereum. You had Ripple, to name some of the most common ones. You had Bitcoin forking into Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash. But you had people creating cryptocurrencies all over the place. In fact, there was someone who amazingly set up a scam website that he said this was basically a cryptocurrency scam and people bought the coin. I think it was called Ponzi coin. I think it was genuinely called Ponzi coin. He then put up a note and said, no, look, this is actually a Ponzi scheme, but he did disappear off with people's money. Now, all of this is not to say that Bitcoin, and we're going to use Bitcoin here as a kind of shorthand for all the cryptocurrencies, is worthless. Bitcoin has some value. It has established itself as some form of store of value that some people thought it was the new gold. I think it's got a couple of thousand years to go before it can claim to be the new gold. But it has established itself in a very short period of time as something of some value. But that doesn't mean that it can't be colossally overvalued. And as you said a minute ago, what we saw this time last year was a mania. Everywhere you went, you could overhear people talking to their friends, family about how they bought into Bitcoin, or you didn't want to buy Bitcoin now, you wanted to get into Ethereum or Ripple, or how they put some more money in because it was essentially this, it's going to the moon. There was a language that had been built up around it. There were stories about all these Bitcoin millionaires. There was a whole Bitcoin subculture. It was all about buying Lambos. They were very much into their Lamborghinis, you know, hodl and things like that. Hold on for dear life. Then all of a sudden, after Christmas, it just sort of started sinking.
Which you say is pretty classic, but then that's when you went, go on then.
Oh yeah, well, you know, there is this classic bubble chart, and actually not only if you overlaid the price of Bitcoin up to the middle of last December onto the classic bubble chart, can you see that it maps out fairly accurately. But if you overlay it since then onto the classic bubble chart, you can see it maps out fairly accurately. I looked at Bitcoin and cryptocurrency throughout the whole of 2017 with a complete astonishment as in what on earth is going on here. However, I can see the potential of it as a long-term store of value. It's not going to be the new gold, but it might be a little bit of the new gold. And if it is, then maybe it could go back up to the levels it was at before. But I think that's a very long-term thing. And I decided to take a small punt on Bitcoin and some other cryptocurrencies because I thought at the start of February last year, when it had fallen back down to $7,000 from that peak of $19,000, that might be the opportunity for a good entry point. It has proved to not have been the opportunity for a good entry point. Just to be absolutely clear, okay?
Yeah.
So I bought $1,200 worth of cryptocurrency. That's £870, split evenly between Bitcoin, Ethereum and Ripple on the basis where I could see in the long term they might go back up. It might be a good entry point, as I said. The Bitcoin's currently down 44%. Mm. The Ethereum is down 86%.
Ooh.
And the Ripple is down 47%. Overall, I am down 59%. As Homer Simpson would say, dull.
Do you regret it, though, or do you think that it will go back?
I don't know. I've still got it. But this was a punt. I knew this was a gamble at the time. I considered this an insurance policy against me being wrong in the fact that I thought these things were hideously overvalued and this was just a complete mania, that actually I might be wrong about that and there might be something in this. A friend of mine, when I told him about this, who actually had invested more money in cryptocurrency, did ask me, have you just taken out an insurance policy against me getting rich? I was like, that's not strictly true, but yes, that's it. But it was a smaller part of the money that I have invested in much more classic and reliable assets, shares, etc. And I was willing to take the gamble, but I knew that it was a gamble at the time.
I was just wondering, given you've written an article about it, could you expense it?
No, you definitely can't expense cryptocurrency. But don't you remember, this time last year, there was the thing about the credit card companies stopping people putting cryptocurrency on their credit card because people were buying more on their credit card. It was a mania.
So before we talk about what we've learned from that, Simon, Myron, is this the future, do you think?
Well, nobody knows. That's the thing. It's just one of those things. It's a new emerging technology. Cryptocurrency purists would argue that emerging technologies carry new ideas, will always see swings in value. And, you know, it's important to note that assets like shares, bonds, or even property have productive element underlying them, whereas cryptocurrency have nothing to back up their value. So, you know, the value is based purely on perception and sentiment. So, it's hard to see the future.
But I'm wondering though, if the things that made it popular,
yeah,
cuts out the middlemen, cuts out a lot of the banking system that people didn't like, it's quicker, smoother, I assume it's private, will still be there in the next iteration perhaps. So it's the things that people like about it will continue to drive its future, maybe?
Yeah, but it's all about sentiment. You know, the markets are based on emotions, you know, and it's what we said in mid-December, that peak was just based on emotions. Everyone was talking about cryptocurrency. You had to be in it to win it. And there's danger that that sentiment could override your overall investment philosophy if you're an investor rather than a trader. You know, you have to think long-term, not necessarily short-term.
Simon?
Yeah, I would entirely agree with Myron, and to sort of talk about the things that I said, what have we learned from it? The first one is it probably is a bubble. Mm-hmm. If it looks and feels like a bubble, then it probably is one. It was not different this time.
Some of your
it
readers,
was a bubble.
Though, disagree. Why are they disagreeing?
Because they argue that I do not understand cryptocurrency. I don't get it, that blockchain technology and cryptocurrency has a use. Clearly, Bitcoin does have a value. If you bought in when Bitcoin was at a couple of hundred dollars, then you'd still be up loads. Therefore, I must be wrong. Now, I'm not actually arguing with the fact that Bitcoin has some form of value.
Yeah.
What I was pointing out is this was a bubble and its value was chased up way above what its true value actually is at that moment in time. Tulip bulbs, for example, do have some value.
Mm-hmm.
You can plant them and you can grow tulips. However, that does not mean that the tulip bubble did not exist. Gold is the longest term store of value that we have. However, if you saw the price of gold do what the price of Bitcoin did last year, the price of gold would be in a bubble.
Mm.
Houses, fundamentally useful. We live in them.
Yeah.
They definitely have a value. Doesn't mean we haven't had housing bubbles in the past. So I think you need to, if you're thinking about investing in stuff, you need to separate these two things in your mind and question it. Don't buy on the fear of missing out. So beware of buying anything driven by the fear of missing out. Basically, it's time to be cautious. If you ever find yourself thinking, other people are making money on this, they could keep making money on this, I need to get in now, otherwise I'm not going to make any money, I'm going to get left behind, you probably want to be thinking very strongly about whether you should be buying something. Watch out for value based on sentiment, as Myron just said, especially if that's combined with the fear of missing out. Diversification can protect you, as I alluded to earlier. If you bought some Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies as a small part of your portfolio, then its plummet from grace will be annoying. It's quite annoying that I don't have as much money as I previously had. However, it's not disastrous. If you chucked everything that you had into cryptocurrency, or you were one of those people who were borrowing money on credit cards to buy cryptocurrency, then what has happened over the past year is probably going to be a big issue for you. And finally, there will always be another bubble. Bitcoin was pretty special. You don't often get to watch that play out to that extent right in front of your eyes. It was pretty amazing. But another opportunity that may not be so spectacular will come along. Markets move in cycles. We talked about this last week. The classic bubble chart works because of hope, greed, and fear. It's human emotion. We are flawed as individuals. We are destined to keep making the same mistakes again and again and again, and we will chase up the price of something else in the future. Lots of people will buy in thinking they'll make lots of money, and if you got in early, you can make money from a bubble. If you get in late and you're the last man standing, if you are the last one in the line of greater fools, you will lose money.
Timing is everything, though. If only everyone could have crystal balls to gaze into. But maybe slow and steady then wins the race after all, Myron. Take Ashted. If you'd invested $1,000 in the industrial equipment rental company 10 years ago, it would now be worth $53,990. And Ashted aren't a one-off. 15 of the FTSE 100 companies have not only raised dividends every year for a decade, but also delivered total returns of more than 500%. So, Myron, firstly, shareholder heroes. What's so good about them? How do you spot them?
They're fantastic. They are investment companies that are able to up their dividend payments to the investors every year. Companies that pay a regular dividend and are able to increase its share price consistently each year are basically the ultimate win for investors. So you have the dividend payout that grows every year, as well as the capital returns, the capital growth.
Is there a general theme like a sector as to some of the companies, the 15 that we're talking about here, that have managed this? Or does it say more about what's going on within the company?
I think it says more about what's going on within the company. It's not, I don't think it's sector specific. I think one thing that is important to remember is that a lot of investment companies have cash, you know, substantial cash reserves. So this means at bad years, they're able to, where they haven't been able to grow their dividend or the dividend staying static, they've able to dip into those reserves to, you know, up their payout to investors.
What are some of the other standouts?
Hargreaves Lansdown, that's a good one. They've managed to increase dividends by 18%, so you pay out a dividend of 80% now, and the total return is 1,512%. So that's a growth in share price over 10 years. And also Croda, a specialty chemical firm, and they've upped its dividend yield to 16%, again, over a 10-year period, and returned, wait for it, 1,182% over that period, which is, you know, pretty decent, I think.
Simon, moral of this story is?
Get into the right place at the right time. And you can always find the best returns by looking backwards. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to spot them in advance by looking forwards. No, I think really more the moral of this story is that the one thing that all of these companies have in common is that they've increased their dividend every year for 10 years. And then what's been looked at is what the share price return has been. And that if you can find a company that does pay a consistent dividend and has the discipline to not only maintain that dividend, but increase that dividend year in, year out, then you have probably managed to find a company that is relatively well run financially, that is financially stable, financially sound, that has a commitment to its shareholders, and that is probably doing quite well in its business. You probably may not get the kind of returns you've seen on Ashtead. Ashtead was hit quite hard by the financial crisis. It does sort of plant hire, basically, and operates heavily in the US. So renting out machinery to building firms, large constructors and things like that. And it has managed to tap into the growth that's been seen since the financial crisis and also did quite badly in the financial crisis, but sort of managed to retain its position and has then managed to expand. And that's why it's done so well. Other companies in there, I suppose Hargreaves Lansdown, like Myron mentioned, it's ridden the wave of the DIY investing boom over the last 10 years. Croda, I don't know much about, but I think the moral of the story is you need to look at companies very carefully rather than just buying them because they sound good and dig into the financial results yourself.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Well, if investing still isn't your bag or you like a mix, you'll be cheered by the flood of new savings deals out this week. These include new easy access ISA accounts from Charter Savings Bank and Virgin Money, paying 1.4% interest, the highest rate available since June 2016. We also got a new market-beating three-year ISA from Challenger Bank Aldermore, as well as a top-paying five-year deal from Charter Savings Bank again. All right, so while nothing great guns, Myron, like, let's not get too overexcited. I mean, this is still pretty welcome news, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. The saving rates have been languishing since the great financial crisis of 10 years ago. Interest rates remained the same at 0.5% since August this year, and then the Bank of England decided to up it to 0.75%. So many banks and building societies have passed on this rate to savers, which is fantastic, and have upped their savings rate, which is good news for savers, but it's just nothing really too exciting, unfortunately.
No, nothing, yeah, let's say nothing too exciting, but we've not had a lot to celebrate, as you said, over the last 10 years. Simon, is it all down to central banks and their decisions to keep interest rates low?
Some of it is. Some of it is also down to something called the Funding for Lending Scheme, which was a way of the Bank of England trying to pump cheap money through to banks and building societies, which they could then use to help them lend out money to businesses and to homeowners. And then another version of that was then launched after the Brexit vote to try and help out banks, because there was a fear there was going to be another credit crunch. Effectively, that money is running out now. So banks and building societies still have some of it in their arsenal that they can use, but they can't get any new money from that. So they are now starting to look to savers a little bit more to pull money in so that they then have money on the side of their balance sheets that mean that they can lend new money out to other people. and they have become a little bit keener on getting in savers cash. Also, there's that old thing called competition that has come into play.
Mm-hmm.
So as some of these banks and building societies either become keener to get some cash in from people, and it tends to be the smaller players what get dubbed the challengers, or they might just be very keen to stake out a position in the market to get their name known. And the most notable example of that in recent times has been our old friend Marcus.
Marcus. Wonder when that name was coming
Marcus,
up. It's been at least a week since we mentioned Marcus.
Marcus by Goldman Sachs, which is Goldman Sachs' new sort of consumer banking brand. They busted their way into the savings market in the UK with a 1.5% easy access rate, which was way above all the other accounts in the market. And now you've seen a number of others slot in behind them.
Mm.
We did see an account that briefly beat it, but that was only for 2 days.
I was about to ask that. They don't last very long, these. I got a Marcus. Why
did
not?
You?
I did, yeah.
You gave some money to the vampire squid.
I did. Well, you put money in Bitcoin.
That's true.
Yeah.
I'm not, mind you, yeah, I mean, who knows who's who knows who's running that?
Exactly. So let's see how it goes. Let's see who's better off at the end of the year. Probably still you, Simon, because I have to put money into mine. All right, Myron, just a quick one. Do you see this continuing to go up?
Yeah, I think so. I think the only way is up for interest rates. It's been far too low for far too long. I think people need to remember that this low interest rate environment we've been in is not the norm. As recently as 2008, interest rates were as high as 5%. And from the 1980s the early 1990s, they generally range between 10 and 15%. So while I don't see a return to those level of rates, I think, yeah, it will go up.
A decade on from the financial crisis, where, if you remember those heady days, you could get 125% mortgage. Are we about to go down that same path? Now, in a report on first-time buyers, the Building Societies Association said the taboo around 100% mortgages was arbitrary and insisted modern technology could help to assess how risky each borrower is before lending. The trade body urged its members to revisit the case for lending to those who don't have a deposit. Remind us about 100% mortgages, please, Simon.
Well, 100% mortgage is when you buy a home with a mortgage, but you don't put any money in yourself. Why would you want to do that? Well, because you can't raise the money for the deposit and in order to buy the home, and you can maybe get onto the property ladder. Your mortgage might actually be less than your rental costs, so why pay someone else's mortgage when you could be paying your own?
Right.
Sounds all good in theory. Obviously, the slight issue is that if house prices dip even by the tiniest amount, you are instantly in a thing called negative equity. Negative equity is not essentially a problem unless you want to move home or remortgage, but you might want to do that sometime. But it does tend to weigh on people's minds. They don't like that feeling of their home being worth less than their mortgage.
What about 125? People might be listening to what on earth?
Yeah, so the 125% mortgage was an outlier in that this wasn't a particularly common thing, but there was quite a few of these taken out. And this was the headlong rush into lending in the cheap credit days of the 2000s. The Northern Rock one, the Together mortgage, was the most famous example. Mm-hmm. And essentially, they lent, it wasn't really a 125% mortgage. What they actually did was they lent you 100% of the property's value and then added on this bolt-on up to 25% of the property's value loan. So once you took it all together, really, it was 125% mortgage, but it wasn't completely structured exactly the same way as a mortgage.
Right.
The problem was, of course, is that talk about being in negative equity if house prices dip by a couple of percent and you've bought with 100% mortgage, or the risk of them happening if you buy with a 95% mortgage. 125%, you're instantly down.
Yeah.
And obviously, what happened was we had the financial crisis, we had the credit crunch, Northern Rock went bust. Nobody in their right mind ever wanted to offer any of these mortgages for a very long time again. We'll probably see them again one day, I imagine. And so all of the people with these mortgages were stuck and they couldn't remortgage. They found themselves on much higher rates than they needed to be because interest rates were slashed in order to deal with the problem. And it's been really tough for them. And some of those people who bought those homes with 125% mortgages, especially if they're in places where house prices haven't really risen, parts like in the northeast and things like that, they've only just got to the point where they've paid off the 25% and they're back down to 100. But they were an outlier. There is an interesting element in this whole debate, though, over small deposit mortgages.
Yeah.
And that is that actually it is not necessarily small deposit mortgages that were responsible for the problems that we had in the property market in the UK and the mortgage crisis over here. Ignore what went on in America. That was their own special problem. But we definitely had one here that would have been much worse if we hadn't have had the canary in the coal mine that was America. Mm-hmm. And then we got interest rates down far enough for us not to have a massive panic here. But if you look at the 1980s and the 1990s, people who bought homes put down smaller deposits in those decades, on average, than they did in the 2000s. First-time buyers in the 2000s were actually putting down bigger deposits than their parents' generation did. So the statistics don't actually back up the argument there. But what there is a concern that if you buy with a small deposit and house prices fall, then you do end up stuck. So there's nothing necessarily wrong with it, but just bear in mind that you might end up stuck. So you need to be living in a property that you are happy to live in for the next 5 years. And also, if you've got a repayment mortgage, you will be paying down the debt slowly over time. The big problem with the 2000s is that people were taking small deposit mortgages as interest-only mortgages. So not only did they not have much of a buffer, they weren't paying down any of the debt either.
Myron, there's a lot of people out there who say, I could easily pay for the mortgage. It's just getting together this enormous deposit that's the problem. And I suppose it's for those people to whom this will be targeted.
Yeah, definitely. But I think one thing that's important to remember is, you know, you have to look at the rate of interest. 100% mortgage will command a higher rate of interest than, say, a mortgage where you can accumulate a 40% deposit. I think that's key. Think about the interest rate. Like a two-year fix, you can get that for 1.2% probably in this current rate. Yeah. Whereas 100% mortgages will command a considerably more larger interest rate. So before anyone dives into a 100% mortgage rate, just have to look at how much you can afford to pay. And I suppose a mortgage advisor would help with that.
Get the calculators out. But I suppose in the past, when people would rent in order to save, renting is so expensive now, it's impossible to save.
I was in a situation where I was renting not too long ago. It can be so, so tiring. You think, oh, well, everyone's telling me I have to own the property, but I'm renting in London because I work in London and it's just so expensive. And you also want a life. You want to go out with your friends or go on a holiday. And you realize after every month, you don't really have a lot to save. You know, that's why, you know, I'm a massive fan. People who know my work, I write a lot about lifetime ISAs and help to buy ISAs simply because they're a fantastic saving mechanism because of the government bonus. So, you know, I'll encourage listeners to think about saving, especially people my age, millennials.
So with that in mind, Simon, there's obviously going to be a market for it. But what about those likely to offer? Do you think we're going to see lots of them?
I think that we might see a return to this kind of thing. There will be something that we see probably before the property market eventually takes a turn. There is usually, and we talked about this last week on the podcast, when we talked about this 18-year property cycle theory and whether there might be another leg up to come. You usually see some kind of euphoric stage at the end where not just people buying homes, but the people lending the money to people to buy homes, i.e. banks and building societies, get a bit carried away. That might not quite be Bitcoin mania, but that you usually see some kind of dramatic loosening of credit. The only question is because we've had interest rates so low and we've had these schemes like funding for lending, we've had help to buy, lobbing people interest-free cash to buy homes and things, have we managed to distort the market to the extent that we don't get that euphoric final bit? But you might see some of the smaller building societies dip their toe in it, some of the challenger banks. I think some of the bigger banks will be considerably more wary just because of the whole legacy thing. And people would be tempted because, if, as you said, if it is cheaper to pay mortgage payments than it is to pay rent, you would think, well, this seems like a good idea because it gets me to be able to do that. There are other costs with running a house, though. If you are renting, then your landlord shoulders most of those costs. If you own the house, then you have to shoulder them yourself. But if you're paying £200,000 for a home and you need to raise a 5% deposit, even just to get that 95% mortgage, you'll need to save £10,000. Saving £10,000 is really, really, really hard. So it's no wonder people would be tempted.
All right, then, let's move on, because it's not just Simon, your consumer affairs editor, Lee Boyce, who gets to go on the adventures. You can remember Royal Mint, IKEA. No. For the sake of This Is Money research only. Simon and his family packed their guitars, donned their flares and stuck flowers in their hair for a 2,100-mile road trip to review a VW camper van. Isn't that right, Simon?
That is true.
It's exactly what happened.
It is, yeah.
What really happened.
Yeah, we all got our flares out. Yeah, from the back of the cupboard. Yeah, we went out into the garden, we made daisy chains, and then we headed off. Mm. No, we took the modern day version of VW's iconic camper van, which is the VW California. And in my role as motoring editor of This Is Money and Mail Online, as well as being This Is Money editor, what we like to do is we like to review interesting vehicles and write interesting stories about them.
Why is this history? There's so much culture around the VW camper van. This is your moment, Simon.
Right.
Go
so,
for it.
A brief history.
Yeah.
The VW camp van was originally launched in 1950, mm-hmm. and it was called the Type 2. The Type 2, referring to the fact that there was previously a Type 1 before it, which was the Beetle, the first ever Volkswagen. And the van became pretty popular. And within about a year, someone worked out that you could start converting these things into a little house on wheels, into a little camper van. Originally, it was done by coach builders, companies that convert cars. And the coach building industry is not quite so big nowadays as it used to be. But if you go back to the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, there were loads of companies that would take a car and personalize it for you. People realized they like these things. The main coach builder that did this was a company called Westphalia. They developed an official relationship with Volkswagen. And over the next 30 years, the camper van, the VW camper van, became a thing. The first ones were the split-screen camper vans. The front window has a line down the middle of it, divided into two panes. Then you had the bay window camper vans after that, pretty much a very similar shape. They were rear-engined, not water-cooled. They were air-cooled, so they had a reputation for overheating. But you could fit a family of four in them, and they could sleep in there, and they also had a kitchen and some cupboards and everything. It was like a little house on wheels, and people fell in love with them, and they became the famous hippie bus, and so on.
Iconic in movies.
Exactly.
And they stopped music videos.
They stopped making the vans in that shape in 1979, although actually they did continue to be produced in some parts of the world, and they only finished being made in Brazil about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Then you got the more angular vans, and then you started to get the more modern-looking ones at about the sort of start of the 1990s. They are now on to, they give them T numbers. So the first ones, you had the T2, T3, so on. We're now on T6. The California is pretty popular, but it still sticks to that VW camper van ideal. It's actually made by VW nowadays, of it can cart a family of four and their stuff around. They can sleep in it, they can cook in it, they can go on holiday in it. And the idea is that it is always ready for adventure.
Yeah, but if you're hoping to read Simon's article, and please do, and see a photograph of the California and expecting it to have little flowers on it and perhaps be yellow and a bit bubbly looking, it's nothing like it, Simon. It may be made by VW, it may be a camper van, but that really is about as close as it gets to its original. No? And hopefully it doesn't break down.
Well, yeah, it's based on a VW transporter van. So the kind of van that you would see a builder driving around or someone delivering, you know, delivering things around and about the place. But that's what the original VW van was. It's just because it was because it was first made in 1950, it just looks a bit older than it does now. The new one is considerably more reliable because it's not air-cooled. It's got a much bigger engine. It is more comfortable. I have experience of both. My father-in-law has a classic VW camper van, 1973 camper van. It's absolutely brilliant. I love that van. I wouldn't drive it to the south of France, though.
No.
The new VW California was an entirely more dependable, comfortable and speedier prospect. And I thought it was great. So basically, read the article. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/cars. But basically, how
does
this work?
You've not got away with it that easy. We want to know your Simon.
Okay,
come on. And
okay.
How much does it cost, first of all? Because let's get that out of the way.
These things are expensive.
They're expensive.
That you get two different versions. You get the Ocean and you get the Beach. Mm-hmm. The Ocean is the one that comes with the kitchen in it. So you get a...
That what you had?
Yeah. Fridge. Double gas burner cooker. Sink. You've got your own water supply that you fill up. Cupboards and then some wardrobes in the back. The Beach doesn't have those things. It just has a seat downstairs that turns into a bed. Both of them have the rear seat, flips down, turns into a bed. And then in the roof, where you would have the roof line of the van, there's also another mattress up there, and there's a pop-up roof that goes up and creates a roof tent, and then you can sleep another two people up there. So you can sleep four people. Raising that roof takes like about 30 seconds. It's very easy. You pull up to your campsite, you park up, You press the button, the roof goes up, you've got a bed upstairs, a bed downstairs, you've got a table that you can pull out, you can spin the front chairs around. If you, in the sliding door on the side, just tucked inside it, is a little picnic table that you can get out. In the boot, in the tailgate, you unzip part of the boot and in there are two camping chairs. You have an awning that pulls out for it. It's your little house on wheels. The one thing you don't have is a toilet. You need to get one of those massive RV-style camper vans if you want that. But it is a great piece of kit.
Costing.
Oh, yeah. You asked you me that, didn't you? Yeah. So the cheaper one that doesn't have the kitchen and everything starts at about £43,000.
Okay.
If you want the version with the kitchen and everything, you're paying at least £50.
Okay.
The one that we tested was a top spec limited edition kind of one, and that costs over £60,000. They do, however, hold their value very, very well. So Cap HPI says that a three-year-old one is worth about 83% of its original price. Most cars lose at least a third of their value in the first 3 years. They are always in demand on the second-hand market, but you're paying a lot of money. I mean, to be honest, I'd be tempted to go second-hand rather than buying one brand new. If you're going to use it, you have to get into that whole adventure thing. You have to be using it all the time to justify running this instead of a family car, because it's bigger, it's more expensive to run, it's not as fuel efficient, but it does have all those other things added into it. And the thing that I think is a useful comparison is that if you take a sort of mid-level premium car nowadays, a kind of the SUVs that people like, an Audi Q5, a Jaguar F-Pace or something like that, a Volvo XC60. It's very easy, once you start getting a bit handy with the options list, which people tend to do, to bump the price of those cars up to £50,000, to about level with the van. So if you compare those two things, you are getting a lot for your money with the camper van. What did we do with it? We started in London. We went across the channel, we zigzagged our way down through France, we stayed in northern France near Reims to begin with, then we went to Chablis in Burgundy, then we went wild camping for a night in southern Burgundy, which was great. We found ourselves a spot to park up. Amazingly, they were on top of these cliffs with a sort of like 360-degree panoramic view across wine country. We then went to Annecy, where we did stay in an Airbnb for 3 nights because there's only so long you can spend in a van with your kids.
That's one of the questions I was going to ask you. Yeah.
Yeah, from there, we then went and stayed in France's version of the Grand Canyon, a place called the Gorge de Verdon, much smaller version of the Grand Canyon, I should add. Mm-hmm. We were on a campsite there for 3 nights. It was brilliant. We then drove down through the hills of Provence to the south of France, where we stayed in a villa for a week with my wife's sister's family. And then we bombed it back in a day and a half and used the old wild camping technique again because we got stuck in terrible traffic, weren't going to make it to our campsite. So we stopped, had dinner, and then found a place to park up just by the side of a field, slept there for the night, got back in, drove it home, 2,100 miles, 2.5 weeks. And I must say, I thought that van was absolutely brilliant.
Survey says out of 10?
9 out of 10.
Ooh. Are you tempted, Myron, for 60-odd grand?
Yeah, you know, that's just walking around my knees.
Yeah.
For me, yeah.
Loose change, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Simon and Myron, for your first time. Congratulations. Now, if you have a question for the team, something you'd like them to cover, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or if you want to join in the conversation, tweet us at thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you will find all the podcast articles and you can get involved in the comments underneath and call me an idiot for buying some Bitcoin.
Exactly. He enjoys it, promise. Don't forget, you're up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you do like us, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little, give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.